I just want to turn to the question of critical source areas, and I think you'll answer the question from one of my friends on that this morning. So I think you agree, that in terms of regulating, rules should aim for best bang for buck, so you aim to get the most benefit out of the rule. And critical source areas are identified as a key source of contaminants from farm under.
Yes.
And I'm just going to read you, this is from the MFE guidance document. I don't have a copy to hand up, but for members of the court, I probably will get one of the witnesses to produce it. I know the MFE guidance documents have had a bit of a bad rap lately, but this is quite a useful discussion. So I'm just going to read out their definition of what critical source areas are and just make sure we're on the same page. So 3.1, general concept of critical source areas. Not all locations on a farm contribute equally to the delivery of contaminants and accordingly water quality degradation. Studies have found that a relatively small fraction of a farm or catchment can generate a disproportionate amount of contaminant flow. Field observations have identified that most storm flow, i.e. runoff during shortly after rainfall, is generated by a small proportion of the catchment. Identifying these hydrologically active areas essential to the design and implementation of water quality management. Critical source areas are those within a farm or catchment that contribute a disproportionately large quantity of contaminants to water relative to their extent. Is that your general understanding?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not the NES definition, though, is it?
It's close, and we'll come back to that. That's... it's a description about what a critical source area might be. In terms of some specific examples of a critical source area, it might be a bit like an elephant. You know when you see it, but it's a bit hard to describe. So it would include things like races.
Yes.
Gates, areas where stock congregate, around water troughs.
Yes.
The bottom corner of fields where water might pool.
Yes.
It's absolutely impossible to write a rule specifying where on a farm a critical source area is, isn't it?
Yes.
It'd be absolutely impossible to write a rule to define what a critical source area is exactly in every case.
Well, yes, but we need to try.
Yeah, and we'll come back to your definition, come back to your attempt later. But it's in terms of best bang for buck, it is important on farm to be able to identify those.
Yes.
And a really good way of identifying those is a certified farm planner walking around a farm with a farmer pointing out.
Yes.
Those are areas you need to manage.
Yes.
As a priority, and that will give you best bang for buck. Correct?
Yes.
Turning to ephemeral streams, and there's some parties seeking stock exclusion from ephemeral streams. So ephemeral stream is essentially a hollow in land that collects and transports water during rain. Immediately after rain. That's effectively what it's an overland flow path.
Yes.
It would be completely impractical to permanently fence or even fence ephemeral streams and the PC won't catch up from that.
Yes.
The farmers would be running around before and after rain events, taking down fences and putting them up.
Yeah.
There's been no assessment of the costs or benefits of excluding stock from ephemeral streams, has there?
No, I mean the panel made it clear that PC1 wasn't about exclusion from ephemeral streams.
Yeah. Because amongst other things of the practicality of it.
I guess so, although I don't know if I read any reason for it, but that was what they said.
But you would agree with me that to the extent that ephemeral stream areas intersect with critical source areas, the managing critical source areas will address ephemeral stream locations.
Yes, probably.
And you pointed to some provisions in D1 which apply all permitted activities that aim to address critical source areas.
Yes.
Turning then to the slope at which fencing is required, so there's a debate between the parties. Some of the parties, including Fonterra and Dairy and Zed, want all farms to have fencing up to 15 degrees. I think the council's position is up to 10 degrees in my points. You said you were agnostic about whether it's 10 or 15 degrees, in answer to a question from my friend before, but you accept that fencing up to 15 degrees would be more expensive as opposed to up to 10 degrees?
Probably, yes.
Well, there's more area to be fenced, isn't there?
Yes.
And it's more expensive to fence on steeper land, isn't it?
Yes.
You agree that the next plan, freshwater plan, should be enforced by around 2027?
Yes.
I know that's a fairly heroic assumption, but you agree that there's no prospect of all the fencing up to 10 degrees being completed on farms by 2027, is it?
Probably not, no.
Well,
I mean, what I'm saying is, again, Schedule C is not just about fencing.
Yeah, no, I'm just working through this, so
yeah.
Just bear with me,
sure.
I'll get there.
Yeah.
You agree that the focus of fencing, and I'll stop using fencing, and I'll use stock exclusion. So I agree that the focus on stock exclusion should be on lowland areas first, i.e. up to 10 degrees.
I don't know if that's the most effective way of protecting water bodies to do those first, but they're certainly the easiest ones to do first.
Right, and if it's more practicable to do it and cheaper to do it and you want to get runs on the board, That's a good thing to do.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's less reason why you wouldn't fence where it's easy, you know, relatively easy to fence. So yes.
And the vast majority of dry stock land is within 0 to 10 degrees, isn't it?
So I understand. Well, yes, I was surprised at some of those figures I heard today.
69.2% is within.
Yes.
So yes. Were you not aware of that?
I wasn't aware of that, no.
And so only 13% of the land is between 10 and 15 degrees.
Yes.
So in terms of the additional cost of going from 10 to 15 degrees, it would cover relatively little extra land.
Yes, so.
I understand the council's currently preparing a LIDAR map of the region.
We are currently getting LiDAR, full LiDAR coverage over the whole region, and I think we're pretty close to that. Once we have that, we can start working on a map. And this sounds easy, but it's much more complicated than it perhaps it sounds, because actually getting the right map, you still have to do some averaging, and so a bit of moving around on that. But yes, we're heading in that direction, absolutely.
Yeah, and so the LiDAR map will give you a region-specific, very accurate assessment of slope on any particular farm in the catchment.
Yes, there'll still be some averaging, but yes.
But it'll be a lot more accurate than the government's low slope map.
Yeah, I understand that.
And a lot more accurate than people going out with an iPhone inclinometer walking along the streets.
Yes, I'd say so.
And ideally that would be in place so that it could be notified in the next plan?
Well, I would hope so, but I don't know where we got from that. I don't know where whether we're close to that or not. I would hope so, yeah.
But the point is that could, if land on slopes of 10 to 15 degrees needed to be fenced, that map could clearly show this area up to 10 to 15 degrees, and that could be done.
Yes.
And it would be accurate.
Yes.
Do you agree that the farm environment plans across the PC1 catchment will require an improvement on all farms? It will inevitably lead to an improvement, I should say, on farm.
I think so, and I hope so, yes.
Are you aware that some parties are suggesting that dry stock farms should be prevented from intensifying by more than 5%?
Vaguely, yes.
So Fonterra and DairyNZ were proposing a limit on intensification at one stage and all being concerned about the in-bracket intensification that you heard about. Do you agree that dry stock farms need flexibility in their operation?
That's the evidence I've heard, yes.
So the freezing works are full, you can't get stock off the land, it's a good year, more grass grows, animal welfare reasons, you might need to get the stock off because of the drought.
Yep.
Numbers will go up and down, won't they?
Yes.
Inevitably.
Yes.
Are you aware that on most hill countries the stocking rate's about 6 to 9 stock units a hectare?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the figures are. I don't know if that's most or not. But yes, I know that a lot of them are around that amount.
So just to be clear again for the court and yourself, so there's a difference between a farm-wide stocking rate and a paddock density rate.
Yeah.
So it's the 18 paddock density rate that causes problems, but the stock, the farm-wide rate.
Yeah.
You understand the difference?
Yes.
So if a 5% increase required a review of a farm plan or said you couldn't do it, are you aware that would be equivalent to 1 2-year-old steer per hectare?
Could be around that much.
Yeah, so it's not very much, is
it? It's a relative term, I don't know what very much.
Well, do you think it would be micromanaging? Saying you're limited to 5%.
I haven't really considered that question of whether there should be some trigger for, a 5% trigger or whatever it might be. I haven't really considered that recently.
Okay, well, my advice is that a 5% increase is an increase of 0.3 to 0.45 stock units per hectare.
Yeah. Yep. Happy with that.
Yeah. And an R2 steer is 5.8 stock units.
Yeah.
So, I'm taking from that you don't support, you don't support an intensity limit on dry stock farming.
I don't think so because the trouble is that, again, I don't know what that really means on a farm by farm basis. I don't know how stocking rate changes on a normal whole country farm, for example, and whether 5% is something that would be a normal change over a year. It's So I just don't know those numbers.
Right. And you don't know the benefits would come from it either?
No.
From limiting?
No.
Turning then to the stock unit limit of 18 stock units per hectare, and I think we could probably go through this pretty quickly. So I think the suggestion in the Fonterra Dairy NZ provisions was 25 stock units per hectare. This is the stock exclusion provisions.
The tax base.
So I don't think I need to take you through this, but do you agree that any limit at that number would prevent rotational grazing?
On that paddock, yes.
Well, if you've got heaps of streams on across your farm, it would prevent rotational grazing on any stream that had access to water.
It would prevent rotational grazing on paddocks that have unprotected streams. It doesn't mean to say that there aren't other ways, as I've said before, or my understanding, of keeping stock out of water.
Yeah, yeah, I'll come back to the provisions.
Yeah.
You'll be pleased to know these are the preliminary questions. Then I've got to get into the provisions. Okay, and then just lastly, in terms of the 50 square metre wetlands, and you are quite correct before, so that was in the decisions version.
Yes.
But as a planner providing your advice to the court, you would, of course, you'd have to make yourself comfortable of all the provisions you're recommending to the court, wouldn't you?
Yes.
So you can't just say, oh, well, the IHP said that, so...
I do rely on a lot of what they say, just because they've heard people have more evidence than what I've heard.
But you have to be satisfied that the provisions you're recommending to the court are appropriate in terms of Section 32.
Yes, as much as I've got information to make those calls, yeah.
Were you aware early on, well, you must have been aware that my clients and others were seeking to increase that limit to 500 square metres?
Yes, yes.
Did you ask for any advice on the costs of fencing tens of thousands of wetlands as small as 50 square metres?
I didn't ask at the time, no.
You agree with me that 50 million, 90 million, 100 million is a significant economic cost?
Yes. Yes.
And you heard the evidence this morning. Do you agree with me now that you wouldn't be comfortable, or you don't think that the 50 square metre per limit is justified in Section 32 terms?
My problem is that I know the costs of the fencing. I don't know the benefits. Mr. Scarsbrook tells me that 50 square metre wetlands have values. So I don't know what, in terms of sort of the ecological values of the water bodies, what we would lose if we went from 50 to 500.
So my clients are being asked to swallow $100 million of extra cost with no idea of the benefits. That's just what you've said.
I don't know what the benefits are.
Well, in circumstances where you don't know what the benefits are, do you think it's justified to impose costs of over $100 million on the farmers in the PC1 catchment?
Probably not, but I don't have the information to answer your question. I don't know in sort of water quality and ecological terms what we would be losing if we went from 50 to 500.
Well, in terms of...
Can't answer that question.
Yes, but the effect of this rule is that you impose the cost, don't you?
We're talking about, again, fencing, aren't we?
Yeah.
So, again, I don't know to what extent all those wetlands need to be fenced to protect them.
The safest, most appropriate process
yes.
to adopt at this stage would be to delete the 50, go to some other numbers, my client's saying 500,
yep.
and do the analysis of the benefits, and in the next plan change, if you can justify a smaller number than 500 square metres, then impose it then. That would be the more appropriate thing to do, wouldn't it?
I don't know if that would be the more appropriate thing to do.
So you think it's appropriate to impose a rule that imposes costs without having any idea of the benefits?
The way, as I said this morning, the way I see Schedule C is it's much more complex than just setting up fencing requirements. And that I understand from the farmers, and this is what I'm responding to, that there's a range of ways that water bodies can be protected. And, you know, there may need to be some, you know, different ways and at different times to protect the water bodies. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I hear from the farmers. That's what I've been told for the last couple of years. So I don't think PC1 is saying you must fence all 50 square metre and larger wetlands. I don't think that's what it's saying. It's not how I read it.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that. But just whether it's stock being excluded or fencing, you understand there's a cost.
Absolutely.
And you have no idea of the benefits.
But I couldn't cost the benefits, and no, I don't know from a kind of ecological point of view or even water quality benefits. I don't know what those are.
All right, can we go to the provisions, please?
Yeah.
So this should be the FFNZ hearing version. Just make sure you've got the right one. I think you've been given a couple of versions over the last few days, so it should be the one with the yellow writing at the top.
Yep.
Yep. So if we just quickly whip through these. So the first, my client's proposed changes are in brown.
Yes.
I'm just going to go to the substantive ones in the interest of time. Policy 2, capital B.
Yes.
So this is the primary policy for farming, isn't it?
Yeah.
So your proposed wording was manage other activities. My clients are suggesting provide for and manage. And the reason my clients are suggesting that is that in their view, it's appropriate to add a more enabling provision to accommodate the permitted activities that are within that policy. Do you agree with that? It's not just about managing effects, it's also for providing for the activity.
I don't have a problem with that.
Okay, so you'd accept provide for and manage.
I don't accept provide for, well, this is where some of these words get really difficult. Provide for, some planners see that as meaning permit.
There are some permitted activities in this.
There are some, but not all of them, yes.
Well, and that's why we've deliberately suggested provide for and manage to accommodate both.
What do you mean by provide for?
My advice is that provide for or enable, the provisions used by, is more enabling and sends a more positive signal than simply managing. Do you agree that it's important? Wording of policies are important?
Yes.
Yeah. And words matter?
Yes.
So do you have any objection if it said provide for and manage?
I think in the context of what Policy 2 is trying to do, which is to achieve the objectives, I would prefer to stay with manage rather than provide for and manage.
Okay. And even though, can you point me to any enabling activity, any enabling policy for anything other than very low risk permitted activity farm?
I'm still not that clear on what your meaning of enabling is. I mean, it's all trying to allow farming to continue. All these provisions are trying to make it so it's practical to keep farming while protecting water bodies. That's the way I see it. So, to some extent, it's all trying to enable farming. But the real point of the policy is to manage it to achieve the water quality outcomes.
Yeah, and I guess I'm putting to you, and it doesn't sound like you agree, which is fine, is that it would be appropriate to recognise the balance, as it does in the CVP section, which has an enable verb. It would be more appropriate to use provide for and manage to be consistent with how the vegetables are treated.
Maybe that's true. Maybe I need to revisit those words.
Well, my friend won't thank me for that. That's fine. I think we can move on.
Thank you.
So the next question, the next one was... Okay, policy 7. So there's some questions about this duration of resource consents.
Yes.
So, and I think in fairness you answered, you made it clear that generally not granting of more than 15 years doesn't mean you get a 15-year consent. You might get a lesser consent, it's just not more than 15 years.
Yes.
And that's what the policy says.
Yes.
So you'll see in our proposed wording there is to make it clear, and in all cases not later than 2014, which is designed to ensure that effectively, so again, that's an upper limit. So in this case, it's designed to make sure that there is a clear delineation that any resource consents that might be granted later in the life of this plan change, understand that it's 2040 is the date. And that change is in response to concerns that consents might be granted for a much longer period. Do you agree that's an appropriate provision?
I'm not sure I understand why you're asking for it and why, from a policy point of view, it's necessary, given that the current wording is without that, is saying no more than 15 years and generally shorter terms as we get closer to plan changes. So I don't really see...
Okay, well, sorry, maybe I didn't explain it and I'll set through it a bit more carefully.
Thank you.
So we don't know how long this plan change is going to last for, do we?
No.
So someone might be applying for consent in 2032.
Yes.
And they could seek a consent that would be potentially up to 15 years.
Yes.
Or they could apply for a consent in 2035. Potentially up to 15 years, which would be 2050.
Yep.
So the purpose of this clause is to make it very clear that if people apply for consents later in time, that there is a fixed and firm deadline that people are aware of. Otherwise, there is no such deadline, is there?
There's no deadline, but I think a consent officer over the years can decide what the latest date should be, depending on where we're going in terms of future plan changes. That's why I don't see the benefit or the need to have that deadline.
You don't think that would give any certainty to people using it as to what sort of duration they might be looking for? They just wait for the consent officer to tell them.
Well, they can look at this and see that in the first one is probably the more likely to get a 15-year consent, but as we get through the years, it's going to be smaller, shorter consent. And that to me is not guidance.
But that's what I don't understand. You say get through the years.
Yeah.
To what?
Well, to whenever the next plan change occurs.
Do we know when that is?
No, we don't. That's the whole point.
And a person applying for consent won't know when it is either, will they?
No, but, you know, in 10 years' time, we might have a better idea of that.
Okay. The next question... So we go to implementation methods. So this is the contextual information for farm environment plans. And you may recall my clients were very eager for the council to be collating and gathering information that could then be used for farm environment plans. That's been a concern of Federated Farmers for quite some time. And that's because it's the council that's in the best position to get catchment information that can then feed into farm environment plans and catchment planning.
Yep.
So the concern of my clients here is the reference that the information would only include significant point source discharges.
Yes.
I don't understand what a significant point source discharge is. So can you tell me what you mean by a significant point source discharge?
Yes. What I mean by significant point source discharges would be from wastewater treatment plants, factories, you know, where there's a fairly large discharge occurring. I mean, it just seems to me that this is supposed to be contextual information so that a farmer kind of understands what's going on in the catchment. I don't think having a whole lot of information about every septic tank discharge or whatever is going to help them in any way to understand what's going on in the catchment. But I think knowing where the major ones are, I think that's probably useful information.
Septic tanks are a point source discharge, isn't it?
Well, it can be. But probably, no, you're probably right. But I mean, what I mean is there needs to be some cutoff. We can't have a requirement here that, I don't know how many discharge consents we have, but I can't see the point in putting all of that into contextual information. I think there needs to be some reasonable level in which it's got to be useful information, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but the concern my clients have is that they're at the bottom of a reasonably small catchment. It has a point source discharge above it that they don't know about. The council does, because they have to keep a resource consent or are obliged to keep records of the resource consent. And that's affecting the water quality, and that those clients don't know about it because it's not in the contextual information provided. Let me just ask this. Is it, and I'm certainly not suggesting that every single discharge consent for every stormwater pipe and everything else be included.
Mm.
But do you think it needs to be slightly broader than just wastewater treatment plants, dairy factories, etc.?
Are you saying that your client, who this, I don't know if that's hypothetical or real, but are you saying your client...
I have a real client.
Okay. So, are you saying that they're going to think, oh, look, there's a big discharge upstream for me, so I don't need to do so much?
No,
I'm really not sure that an abstract discussion with the witness is helpful. I think that's probably a matter for submission.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, one of the things that Commissioner Hodges has worked on is quite a long list of information items that might assist us, and possibly we should add to that, Commissioner, indications of the numbers of point source discharges that the council has records of. But I do think you're in a position to make submissions on this method and the reasonableness of restricting information about point source discharges.
Thank you. I can move on, sir.
Thank you.
So the next section is the rules section. And if we just go to the note at the top. And again, you've had the benefit of seeing our provisions, so... and hopefully have a think about it. So you'll be aware that the note was suggested by Federated Farmers because they were concerned about how farmers would apply these rules. The proposed rewording of A, do you understand that the intention there is just to make sure there's no averaging of discharges across different properties like fertiliser, etc.? It would be inappropriate to average that across properties separated by quite some distance, wouldn't it?
That's right. I'm not sure why that needs to be there rather than, I mean, the rule already says that discharges needs to be for the property. I'm not sure why that needs to be up the front there.
Okay, but it's important, let's just get to the guts of it. It's important that people should not be able to average out fertiliser use across quite separate areas. That's inappropriate.
Yes.
In terms of in the wording in B, the suggestion is that where resource consent is needed, the activity status which applies to the highest risk activity. Do you agree that's appropriate?
Yes.
And if someone chooses to do one farm environment plan over a number of different activities, then the requirements of that farm environment plan will be driven by the requirements of the most risky activity?
Well, I think the requirements of the environment, like the farm environment plan, need to respond to the risks. That's a different thing to the consent category.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand. There were two questions.
Yeah.
So if someone's doing if someone's got a dairy operation and they're running an arable block and they want to apply for one farm plan between them because they're moving stuff between, Or if someone's got two or three farms and they want to run them under one farm environment plan,
yeah,
because they're moving stock around,
yeah,
and well, firstly, do you think that's an efficient approach? A farmer being able to apply for a farm environment plan over multiple properties where stock's transferred between them at different times of the year?
I think it needs to be a limited ability. And this is where I think that my definition of single operating unit is important. So, like I tried to explain earlier, I think the sort of regulatory requirements and requirements of farm plans need to be related to, you know, an operation, if you like, rather than lots of different farming operations.
Even if it's undertaken by the same family. Farmer A has a farm in this location.
Yeah.
The stock are there for 1 year.
Yeah.
They're moved to be finished on another block, which is a kilometre away.
Yeah.
They can't average out the discharges between them. That would be inappropriate, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But wouldn't be inappropriate to have one farm environment plan. It's clearly setting out what's happening on that property and what's happening on that property, but being able to apply for one farm environment, that would be efficient.
Again, Mr. Matheson, aren't these legal matters? I mean, the first item is the planning unit and the case law on planning units and how they're to be assessed. And the second one is the standard rule that the most restrictive activity status will apply, given that there has to be compliance with all relevant rules.
Yeah, thank you, sir. I'm happy to move on and deal with that submission. The interim permitted activity rule in Rule 2, can you just help me with that? So it says farming is undertaken in conformance with the minimum farming standards in Schedule C.
Yep.
So that rule will come into force immediately on the plan becoming operative?
Yes.
Do you agree that it would be appropriate to limit that? Or the concern my clients have is that clauses 1 to 5 relate to stock exclusion that aren't required to be done straight away.
Yes.
And they don't want to be in breach of that rule.
Yes, that only applies to permitted activities, doesn't it?
The interim permitted activity rule.
Are you concerned that...
That applies to everyone prior to getting resource consent. So you know how you have to... your rules say that apply for resource consent over a period of months?
Yep.
Yep. My clients are just concerned to make sure that this rule doesn't say they have to comply with every element of Schedule C immediately on the plan becoming operative, because there are some elements that they can't comply with immediately, the stock exclusion, etc.
Yes, they don't have to comply immediately. At the moment, it would be in terms of stock exclusion provisions.
Okay. Well, that's fine. As long as we understand each other, that might just be a drafting issue.
Okay.
So that's fine. On Rule 3, 4.3, the permitted activity rule, the suggestion is to add in for arable cropping the property is greater than 20 hectares.
Yes.
And that was to make it very clear that if someone wanted to do an arable cropping of more than 20 hectares, they know where to look. Are you happy? Is there any downside to including that certainty in the plan?
I haven't thought of that probably in enough detail. I haven't really had the time to do that. To me, it's clear that you're either covered, if you're in arable farming, then you're either covered by 3.11.4.1 or 3.11.4.3. 3.11.4.1 is only for properties under 20 hectares, so I would have thought that it's clear that arable farming over 20 hectares is managed through that rule. The difficulty, I think, is... these rules do get a little bit complex, I must admit. Um, I might have to think a little bit further about that.
Okay.
It, on paper, it seems to me that, you know, if you're not meeting those three LM4 one conditions, then you go to three LM4 three. And so I would have thought that's kind of where it goes anyway.
Yeah. My client's concern was we argued about it for about 2 hours. And so the suggestion is put in. But if you need to think about it, that's
I
fine.
Would like a little bit more time to think about it. I just remember thinking about this a little bit and thinking it's more complex than it first seems.
Yep.
And it's like a bit more time on that.
Just the next condition, and I think I mentioned this in an to my friend, there's a suggestion there that for the reporting requirement in the condition 4 for dry stock farms. And that records are kept, and I think you are asking that.
I think it's very reasonable.
Yep. Turning over the page, there's a reference, and I want to come back to the NMLR. There's a reference in the controlled activity rule standard. You'll see there in 2, farming is undertaken with the minimum farming standards accepted. In the case of stock exclusion, we're a longer time frame of no more than 10 years for compliance. So the intention there is that if you can't comply with permitted activity standards and you need to get a controlled activity consent so you can't comply with the permitted activities, you apply for resource consent, you can only get a resource consent for 10 years maximum, and the 10 years is 10 years from the plan becoming operative, because we didn't want people waiting 5 years and then applying for a 10-year resource consent.
I'm still worried that 10 years is way too long when it doesn't have to be always fencing.
Yeah.
It just seems too long to me. And I would also prefer that the timeframes are really clear in the schedule rather than the rules.
Okay, but wherever we put the timeframes, and that's no more than 10 years. There's nothing to stop it being required to be done soon.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I want to get to the restricted discretionary activity rule, if we can just quickly go there.
Yes.
So that's rule 7A.
Yes.
So my client's proposal there, you'll see, is to add into the high-risk dairy farming any other farming activity which can't meet this condition, standards or terms. So you have a combo restrictive discretionary activity rule, which will include high-risk dairy and for property that didn't meet the standards and terms. And then if you look over the page, you'll see that there's a list of restrictive discretionary matters.
Yes.
And then for farming that does not comply with standards, any objective or policy which is relevant to the standard term and condition, purpose of the standard term and condition, the effects of the infringement, including the alternative mitigations proposed. So the intention of that rule was to ensure that if you didn't comply with one of the standards, you didn't get tipped into a full discretionary activity. You simply apply for a restricted discretionary activity, and there's a clear guidance as to what you need to assess. Do you think that would be an effective and efficient way to address that consent requirement?
I still don't feel I've had enough time to look at that carefully. I'm very sorry, because
okay.
I know you want to respond.
No.
It does seem to me that it kind of opens up this rule to other situations that I'm less sure I understand. The way it was originally set up, to me, it was a much clearer rule, which made me more comfortable with being a restricted discretionary activity rule. With these additions, my initial view was that it seemed to open it up in many ways, which I just couldn't get my head around at the time, in terms of what are the implications, what could be the implications, and can we make sure that that can easily be controlled. I mean, even your new matter of discretion 2 is pretty complex. So my initial feeling was that I prefer it how it was, just much easier and much more straightforward as to who gets in there, and if there are other reasons besides just being a high-risk farm, my initial feeling was that that should be full discretionary.
So if someone breached a standard, a very limited standard for doing a very limited thing, they have to apply for a full discretionary activity against all of the objectives and policies in the plan, with no guidance as to what they need to assess.
Yes, and we did lots of thinking about this, including trying to rewrite things to produce a rule that would work in that way, it just depends on, well, which standards are they not meeting, how many standards are they not meeting, what does it actually mean in terms of potential effects and so on. And it's very hard to write a rule that allowed that, which is why I prefer to just be left as a discretionary rule after that.
So in addition to the wording proposed, so that's the intention of these RDA criteria, is to guide the planner.
Yeah.
And the other matter you could add to that, and the effect of this infringement in conjunction with any other infringement, that could be added to it. But if that wording was added into these criteria, that would provide clear guidance, much clearer guidance than a full discretionary activity order.
It may provide clearer guidance, but it doesn't tell me what are the potential effects, what's the extent of potential effects that might be addressed through that rule. I'm just less sure of what those are if we do it that way. That's my initial view of this.
Can you tell me how discretionary activity assessment would do that?
Well, it just means that you've got broader scope in terms of addressing that particular farm situation. Why can't they meet these standards? And you know, and what do you do about that? It's just an easier way to do it. And I don't see personally a huge difference in process between an RDA, in my view anyway, and a discretionary activity rule, enough to sort of create a kind of headache by allowing, as an RDA, something where I'm still not sure what the range of potential effects could be under that.
Okay, that's fine. Can we go to Schedule A, please?
Yes.
So this is the registration with the council. And I've just got some questions here about your proposed wording. The first one is 4D, the description of the activities as at 22 October 2016.
Yes.
Is that designed to address concerns about land use change or something else?
Yeah, it's supposed to be a marker at, you know, what was going on at the time this whole thing was notified. That was the point of it, so that you could do it again next time round as well and produce another marker and see what's changed.
So if somebody's bought a property, they would need to go back and find out what was happening on the farm in 2016.
Well, that's right, and is that practicable? I think in most cases farmers do know. There may be some situations where it could be difficult. Yes, I accept that.
They wouldn't know. Would they know their stocking rate or the exact layout from 7 years ago? How much detail is the council wanting through this rule, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the information that's listed there. Description of land use activities and the activities undertaken. I'm assuming that's pretty high level. You know, is it a dairy farm? Is it a dry stock farm? Was there cropping going on at the time? It's pretty basic stuff. I would hold it forward.
Okay, well, that's helpful. The next question I have is that if, where the land is used for grazing, you are suggesting a requirement for the annual stocking rate?
Yes.
My clients oppose the inclusion of that because they don't see the benefit of providing a one-off number of an annual stocking rate, and they see no benefit from providing that information. Can you tell me what the Hari May benefit is?
The benefit, from my point of view, is that if we only know about stocking rate during the winter period or 3 months of the winter period, then we don't know about what's going on for the rest of the year, for example. And so it just felt to me that if we had an annual stocking rate at the time of registration, it would give us again a marker that can be compared with the future. Winter stocking rate, I mean, for a start, it's a threshold, it's a rule threshold. It's not necessarily telling us the intensity over the year of what's going on the farm. That's the only reason that I think it's useful.
But this isn't repeated, the annual stocking rate, is it? It's just a one-off.
That's right.
And it will happen at different times across the catchment as people register.
That's right, yeah.
and stocking rates on farms vary month by month, farm by farm, don't they?
Yes. Yes, it is. It is just it's just the picture of it at the time.
Turning then to Schedule B, and this is where probably it's worth 5 minutes just on explaining the and I understand your the responses you made about the reference to Overseer and the use of the NLLR, and hopefully you've had a chance to think about Federated Farmers and Beef and Lambs proposal. So the proposal is, and there's lots of changes throughout it that I'm not going to take you to, but the proposal is simply that that remains as an alternative drafting gate. So some farmers in the catchment, I don't know if you're aware, they are still collecting and using the Overseer data.
Sure.
So the OCD farmers, for example,
are
still using Overseer.
Yes.
They're still collecting the data.
Yes.
They haven't had any exposure to the nitrogen risk scorecard. They understand what the Overseer number means on their farm. So my clients are concerned to ensure that the PC1 rules become operative as soon as possible. And that going through a 293 process may delay even further a plan change which is significantly overdue.
Yes.
Do you understand that?
Yep.
So the intention of this is simply to provide a one-off drafting gate so that people can, if they have an Overseer number, they can look back at the table at the, in the schedule which says whether they are low, moderate or high, and they'll know what activity status they are, and then they apply for consent.
Yep.
There's no ongoing requirement, there's no ongoing effect.
Yes.
But they might look at that and they might say, okay, well, I'm moderate with my Overseer number, and they might go to the cost of getting an NRS score, and they might be low, so they might choose to go into the low category. So they might do that, so we accept that as a risk. But what's the... There's no additional cost for those farmers because they already had the Overseer number.
There's no additional cost for them to get the NRS number either.
Right, but they've got the Overseer number, they know it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, like I said, it's just, to me, it's not good plan writing to have an alternative gateway that could mean you could go one rule or another. It just doesn't work for me.
But I think you answered an answer to my friend in terms of questions about the NRS gateway. Both the Overseer gateway and the NRS gateway, the only purpose is to effectively break up farms into high, medium and low. And there might be some differences around the edges, but ultimately the numbers are going to be about the same, aren't they?
Percentage-wise, yes, I think so.
So what's, I guess, versus the delay caused by going through a 293 process, wouldn't it be more efficient and more effective to leave Overseer drafting gate in there and just get the show on the road?
I just don't accept that it's good planning to have different gateways where effectively a farmer will have a choice which rule they go into depending on which gateway they use in some cases.
But it is
doesn't seem the right way to write a rule to me.
Okay, that's fine. But in terms of a farmer getting an NRS scorecard, they might look at an NRS score and go, oh, well, if I make that change and lower my effects, I might fall into a different category.
But that should be fine.
Yeah, but that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Because people are causing less effects.
Yes. That's right. But that's a different question, I think.
I think we've probably been through Schedule C. But if we can quickly just go to it, so we've talked about the stock exclusion, and then you'll see the proposal in Roman 3, which is the what I discussed, I think, with some of the witnesses, Mr. Brockstock, yesterday. So the proposal there would be, so the stock exclusion regs apply, and if they're more stringent, they apply full stop. So for the non-stock exclusion, what's being proposed is 3 metres from the outline of the water body, unless a certified farm planner says that a minimum of 3 is not practical, in which case the minimum setback should be 1 metre and an average of 3 is certified. So that's the proposed wording. that my client has developed in order to try and get some flexibility. Retain a minimum of 1 metre, retain some flexibility by a certified person to be able to walk around the land with the farmer and agree what's the best location. And that's effectively a very similar approach to what you've recommended for the stock exclusion above 10 degrees, isn't it?
It's still, to me, if the right number is 3 metres, and that's what I keep hearing from people, not 1 metre, then that's what the limit should be. If you're going to fence, if you have to fence, there may be other ways to do it.
And by the people that you've been hearing this from, that's the scientists?
No, and Mr. Broxall as well.
Yeah, okay. But you accepted, I think, earlier that you need to take a wider range of matters into consideration than just water quality elements.
In setting the distances, yes.
And in developing the rules.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, can we go over to... we've talked about the wetland, so we can go to the cultivation provision. So did you hear the discussion with Mr. Brockstock? Sorry, I'm keeping... Sorry. So the proposal there is rather than a blanket 5 metres any time of the year, any slope, the proposal is to have effectively 5 metres during risky times and 3 metres during non-risky times. And I understand, stood the witness to be comfortable not with 2 metres that I'd propose, but with 3 metres.
Can you explain risky times? I must admit, it's quite dark here. My eyes aren't very good, and I'm not reading this very well.
We get home.
Yes. What do you mean by risky times?
Well, the risky, you'll see there, it's the dates, and I'm having trouble seeing too, but mine's an age issue problem. During the period 1 September to 30 April is the non-risk, so it's basically summer. So you can't do it in winter and you can't do it in winter.
Yeah, I'm afraid I have a real problem, and I still do as a general thing, with saying that the risk of rainfall creating runoff is a winter issue. I just don't think it really is anymore, personally.
So, and that would be why you'd say it should, is that why you say it should be 5 metres?
As a Schedule C standard, yes, I think that's right. And when I think about, those graphs that I've seen about sort of, how much sediment removal there is in different, over 5 metres or 2 metres or 3 metres, it just seems that a 5 metre buffer for cultivation, it seems appropriate in terms of protecting water bodies. Even on relatively flat land.
Was that the... just so that I'm clear and I can take another witness to it,
yep.
But was that the diagram that showed diminishing returns? Of
yeah, I think it was said the farm systems. Farm systems...
Yeah, and you would support. So if there was a point at which it became diminishing returns after that, that's the point at which you would say it would be appropriate.
When I look at that graph, 5 metres seems about the right place. So it's not the best. You're not removing everything. You'd get much better at 10 metres, but it's better than 2 or 3 metres.
Okay, and you think that point on the graph, just to be clear for the record, because I don't know how to get the graph,
yeah.
You say that that graph is at 5 metres.
I'm just a planner, but it just seems a reasonable amount.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. I just need to understand the logic. Yep. Okay. I'm just checking. Okay, so if we can just go to the definitions, the glossary, just a couple of points on here. So I won't bother with the annual stocking rate, you've talked about that. So the definition of critical source area. So this is going to be quite a key definition. You agree with that?
Yes.
So you'll see there that the proposal is to add in the words "and that contributes," so areas that do your A and B, which my clients agree with, "and that contributes a disproportionately large quantity of nitrogen, phosphorus, and organic pathogens relative to the area, generally where contaminant sources overlap." So that was that quote that I read to you from the MFE guidance document. And the reason for suggesting that addition is because the concern otherwise is that there might be huge areas of the farm that are a landscape feature that accumulate runoff from adjacent land and that delivers or has the potential to deliver any of those contaminants. So the concern is that that's such a broad definition, it could be anything, whereas the addition of C narrows the focus down to those areas that are disproportionately more risky. Do you agree that would be helpful?
I mean, the problem is I'm trying to align as much as possible with the national provisions, and so the definition I've put in there is the NES definition of critical source areas, so I prefer not to change that. I think this comes down to how you implement this, and again, I think it's implemented through farm plans. So I think you can have those discussions about what to do about it without needing to change the definition from what's the national.
But as a concept, just so we agreed on that, you agree that that concept is sensible in terms of trying to provide more specificity as to the areas of concern.
To me, the important thing is what the words in the definition currently say, that where there is a risk or potential for delivery of contaminants to water bodies, then that's what a critical source area is. I don't think we need to define that anymore in terms of a disproportionately large quantity of contaminants relatively to their extent. To me, that's just getting too complex. I think the discussion needs to be, so okay, here's your critical source area. In this case, what's the practicable thing to do through a farm plan? I'd rather have dealt with that way. I don't think those words... I understand what you're trying to do, but I think that's starting to lose what's important about critical source areas, which is just a source that, depending on the rainfall, has potential to deliver contaminants to water.
Well, with respect, it's slightly more specific than that, but the definition that the you crossed out, recommended crossing out from from the decisions version, means those areas of farmland that contribute a disproportionately large amount of sediment, phosphorus, and microbial pathogens to surface water.
It's hard to know what it means, but my point was I was trying to align it with the national regulations because it seems sensible to do that where we can.
Yeah. Okay, can we go to the definition of property? So you'll see there the only difference that's proposed is to add in the word lease or. The farming evidence explained in some detail that they have various property arrangements, leasing from grandparents, family trusts, iwi trusts sometimes make land available and get a return on it. You wouldn't have any objection to including the words lease or owned, would you?
Possibly not. Again, I haven't read this one. I don't think I've got that far, I'm afraid. Can I just say possibly okay with that?
I'll say possibly. just the last question is the table of stock units. So you'll see there's some suggested changes as a result of the evidence. As a result of the advice that's been received. You'll see there it clearly has a stock class as at a certain date every year. And then it tries to explain in very clear terms, because the winter stocking rate is going to be important, the cattle winter stocking rate is going to be important. Do you agree that those amendments add useful clarity to the meaning of each of those definitions?
They probably do. I haven't looked at this in detail, and it's not really something that I could comment on anyway. I agree with you that we need the stock class to be clear what we're talking about, and we need to know what the stock number is. So if that improves that, well, that's great. Are they the right words? I have no idea.
Right. I just skipped over this. Can we just go to page 24? It's back to the methods implementation again. And it should be on this document on page... you'll probably get there quicker than me. So the one I'm after is page 24 of that document, and it's Koikart and Canada Geese.
Yes.
So my understanding is that you've crossed out management and control of Koikart, which caused some excitement by my clients as to why that was being crossed out, but I understand the reason for that is that it refers to management and control earlier on in the sentence. Is that correct?
To remember why it was crossed out. This was this came through the mediation. So I think you're right, the words come first.
Okay. But you agree that it's important to manage Koikart in terms of the remobilisation of sediment. It's one factor that needs to be managed in the catchment, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's why there's a specific method referring to it?
I assume so. I wasn't the one who wrote it in the first place, but I assume so. I mean, certainly understand that that Koikart need to be managed as best we can, yes.
And I don't know if you read Mr. Cameron's evidence, but he expressed a degree of frustration about trying to put in a barrier in the drain to stop Koikart coming up the drain to spawn.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting there's scope for this plan change to do that. But in terms of Te Tūru Whai Mana and everyone doing their bit, do you think it would be appropriate for the council to support farmers and others who are looking to do those sort of activities in drains and water bodies through a permissive planning regime?
To allow people to put barriers in streams?
Appropriately designed barriers that allow other native species and other things to go through, but try and prevent Koikart multiplying.
Yeah, maybe, but it would need to be through proper regulatory processes.
But as a concept.
I think the NPS has been changed to allow that in some cases, but I think we need to put the right rules in place around it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you very much, sir. Thank you for appearing.
Cool. Thank you, Mr. Matheson. Mr. Kabilko, I don't think we'll start with other council. I think the next on the list would be Ms. Carruthers, and I imagine you'll take more than 7 minutes.
I can confidently say I've got far in excess of 7 minutes. I also think, though, that Ms. Forrett might be on the line, and she...
Oh, is she?
Would you go for me, I think, in the list? She just hasn't been here for the other
one. No, that's right. Are you there, Ms. Forrett? Anyway, we can come back to everyone tomorrow at around 9:30. Mr. Cavorto, this is like lunch except it's overnight, so just pick yourself and rest up and get your energy back for tomorrow. Ms. Onley, do you have very much for this witness?
Yes, I do, but I'm going to try and keep it short given Ms. Tumai's questions.
Certainly.
If I wanted to put a time on it, I'd say half an hour to three quarters of an hour.
Yes, right.
Probably close to three quarters.
Yes, I would say an hour, maybe a bit more.
Mr. Ferguson?
I'm probably, as long as you can, half an hour to 45.
Mr. Njuri?
45.
prior to now?
Yes. I expect we should be able to complete your cross-examination tomorrow, Mr. Trebilco. I'm not sure that there'll be much time left in the day.
Yes, sir. I've been liaising with experts and
yes.
the Director General. Of the four that were on AVL, two of those are able to attend in person.
In person. I've been thinking that what we may see if we can do, and what if your witnesses are able to do it, is that although a number of us will be gathered in one place in Hamilton for the hearing, if there are people who are able to attend through Microsoft Teams online, I think we should be able to accommodate that. And so what we may do is conduct the hearing of your witnesses as if it were being done remotely, except that a large number of us will be in one place. Do you want to think about that and check with your witnesses about that? But if they have access to a computer with a camera and a microphone...
Yes, we use Teams, Your Honour. So
indeed.
It's certainly an option. I will talk with them.
Yeah, all right. Have a think about that. I'm sorry we haven't been able to get to your case before
now. No, completely understand.
But it does mean that you'll be able to proceed in the order that was originally planned for and also keep your case together, which I think would be desirable.
Yes, sir, in commencing with legal submissions.
Yes. Well, and as I say, we have your written submissions, so we'd be looking more for a presentation. You may well have things that you want to add to your submissions,
yes.
given the answers you've obtained in cross-examination and other answers.
Yes, sir.
With the counsel's witnesses.
I'm mindful, sir, that the court also had some issues you would like me to consider in relation to legal submissions. Would you like rather raise those next week, or would you like to give an indication tomorrow, perhaps?
I'm just trying to think about what you may be talking about. The one set of issues that is occupying my mind at the moment is the further information that Commissioner Hodges raised, and he's prepared a list. I suggest we send that out tonight. All right? We'll be sending out a note. The registrar will send out a copy of the list that Commissioner Hodges has prepared. It is a lengthy list, and there are a number of items in it that I expect could not be answered immediately. But if you, and I think most of it would probably be for the council in terms of its information, probably GIS information that it may have. But if you were able to give us an indication of what could be supplied reasonably quickly, what may take a little bit of time, what you think may be problematic in terms of some of the... a number of matters are likely costs, and it may well be that those are matters that would require someone to make an assessment. All right?
Yes, thank you. Could I just add one more thing to that? That list was prepared very quickly over lunch, and I went from memory on certain setback distances and things like that. What we're really trying to do is make sure that we have all the information to cover all of the options that Fish and Game and the Director General have asked for us to consider. So if I've got them wrong, I'd be very grateful if you'd correct them for us. So the opportunity is there for you not only to comment on how to do it, but whether the questions are right.
Thank you. If I can just say, sir, that the table prepared by Mr. Mafferton doesn't quite reflect Fish and Game's position at this point. So thank you. We'll take the opportunity to correct that.
Yeah, we see this as an opportunity to make sure that everyone gets a fair shot, that we cover all of the options that are reasonably practical. And so I've tried to do that, but I may not have got it right, so the opportunity is there to change that.
Thank you.
I'd be very grateful, Mr. Matheson, if this is the table you're talking about, isn't it? The setbacks?
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't refer to that table.
I know. Could you provide the registrar with a copy of that? As a Word document format,
Yeah, and I'm happy to take advice from my friends as well.
Yeah, but there may be some other things, and if we can maybe make some amendments, additions to it for working purposes.
Just while I'm on my feet, and having experienced Commissioner Hodges' questions before, Dr. Lemire's evidence does have, I'm just asking whether that's been looked at, because he has a number of facts and figures about areas of land use and dry soil theory, different parts of the catchment, and I'm not sure if that's on the list, I'm just guessing, but I just wanted to indicate that that his evidence does have some maps and tables, so that might be useful as well.
It may well be a useful source of information.
Yeah.
I've read that evidence very carefully, and as I have with all the evidence, but I've just posed specific questions that I think we need to look at from a Section 32A point of view, that's all.
Just wanted to raise a question.
Thank you.
Look, you all get a copy. I've sent it through to the registrar, and she can just send it straight on, essentially, as discussed. Total indicative lengths of following stream types, indicative length of streams already fenced with some variations in relation to that, assessments of indicative proportions of streams on certain slopes, lakes, wetlands, and the issue of because the evidence we have is order of magnitude type statements about numbers of wetlands of different sizes, the 500 square metres and 50 square metres. And some gathering together, and perhaps Mr. Matheson and Mr. Minhinnock, this will be where you can assist the council, which will be estimated costs for both dairy and dry stock farms of the various tasks that are being undertaken. Now, obviously, if there are references to existing statements of evidence that in the pace of getting through the documents we may not have noted down, those cross-references would be extremely helpful to us.
Sorry, Your Honour, there's one other thing that is relevant. I've suggested using an average cost for fencing of $15. If that's not the right figure, it's fine for you to comment on that as well. But it's really to try to take an average of some electric fences, some more permanent fences. And just, we're not going to get this right.
No.
We're just going to get it as close as we can in a reasonable time frame.
As Mr. Minhinnock and I have said, there's an illusion of precision in all of this. But the other thing that is added at the very end of the list is a commentary on maintenance costs. I mean, obviously, there are the capital costs that are involved in all of this. All of the farmers will be saying, well, we put these things in and then we have to maintain them. So that is probably also a relevant matter. And as I say, it's an indication at this stage of when that information could reasonably be provided, and we can come back to it tomorrow.
Your Honour, I'm honoured that you haven't put more comments on. You normally double the length of my question.
It's a matter we'll discuss. Is there any other matter that anyone wishes to raise before we adjourn for the evening? No? 9:30 tomorrow is still convenient for everyone? Very good. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you.